Your theme this month is invitation. So thank you for inviting me here. When I heard that the theme was invitation, I remembered something I hadn't thought of since I was about 7. I grew up in Charleston, West Virginia, going to a small UU fellowship where people drove from about a 50-mile radius to get there. We did not live in a predominantly UU world there in West Virginia. And so that fellowship was one of the few places where I could relax. In my home neighborhood, games of house or school might quickly degenerate into my siblings or me being told that we were going to hell and people praying for us. So it was fabulous to see the other kids at the fellowship who were similarly unconcerned about hell. And we often begged our parents to go to each other's houses in the afternoon. So one day I asked if I could go to Kathy Tweedy's house. And as I think back, I bet my mother was stalling for time with her answer. I bet what she was thinking about, this is a parent's mind now, is how much of my afternoon will I have to spend driving to pick you up if you do that? Because she said something kind of unusual. She said, "Did you receive an invitation?" And I said, I was confused, "No." She said, "Well, then you can't go." And I said, "Why can't I go?" "Because you weren't invited." "I was invited, but you didn't receive an invitation." Now we're both confused, right? To me, an invitation meant one thing. It was these little cards that came in the mail. They usually had a puppy or a kitten on them, and they were usually inviting, they were about the only mail I ever got, printed in a kid's careful hand, inviting me to a birthday party. That's what an invitation meant. Being invited, that was more kind of language that I knew. So when I heard your theme this month, what I pictured was a little invitation with my name carefully printed on it coming to my house. But as I know now, there are many, many, many ways that we receive invitations, all forms of them. Sometimes, like Billy Collins' narrator in the poem Consolation, I have not wanted to accept invitations for something new, preferring the familiarity and comfort of staying exactly where I am. But most of the time, like Rumi, I have wanted nothing but to spread my wings and lift off, always excited to be invited to out of various cages. Sometimes I have needed the change that he describes when he says, "We should split the sack of this culture and stick our heads out." I was just in that state of mind, the sack-splitting state of mind, the day that the police officers who killed Eric Garner, the black man selling loose cigarettes in New York, who died saying, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe, I can't breathe," and whose killing, like so many others, was available to all of us to watch on YouTube. The day that those officers were found innocent of any wrongdoing, I needed to split the sack of this culture. I felt that the sack of the culture was smothering my soul as surely as it smothered his body. And I needed to find other people who felt the way I did. And so I accepted a Facebook invitation. It was an invitation to a meeting with other people who felt as I did. And so I took my 18-year-old kid and we went. The people at the meeting mostly turned out to be more like my kid than me, young people of color. My teenager knew many of them. I did not. I sat quietly like grandma in the corner, listening and keeping a carefully neutral face. Neutral as talk quickly turned to, "Which highway should we take over?" And began to discuss the pros and cons of different actions. Every fiber of my old white woman self wanted to scream, "Take over highways? That's a terrible idea. It's not safe." But while I had been invited to the meeting, it was clear to me that I knew nothing about the sense of danger and lack of safety that these young people lived with day after day. So I remained quiet and listened. Soon plans were made and roles were assigned. I left the evening in a daze. When the 18-year-old asked casually on the way home, knowing of my lifetime of activism, "What highways have you ever taken over, Mom?" I gulped and said, "None." And so it was that soon after, I joined with a number of others to march down Highway 35W. Actually, I stayed on an overpass with two other people. One, a very pregnant Ashley Haran, who you heard about is going to be ordained next week. She was just about to pop, and that baby has been to more demonstrations since than any baby I've ever met in my life. So she and I and another friend who's has chronic fatigue and really couldn't go down the highway stayed to talk to the drivers who were on the off-ramp and who were being inconvenienced by this action. The purpose of this action and so many others like it that we're seeing around the country is to disrupt business as usual so that the crisis of violence and harassment, which is disrupting Black families and Black communities, is felt by the majority and felt by white people. By now, at this demonstration, the phrase Black Lives Matter had begun to be chanted and proclaimed across the nation. It was on that highway overpass that I first experienced the phrase, all lives matter, spoken as a curse, rather than as the statement of faith it had always been for me. All lives matter. Of course they do. Of course they do. But if all lives matter, then a subset of that is also true. Black lives matter. When people rolled down their windows and snarled, all lives matter, I would smile and say, yes, and continue to hold my sign that said, Black Lives Matter. This past year, UU congregations and other people with signs up, as I'm delighted to see you have here, that say Black Lives Matter, have seen the word black cut out of their signs, spray painted over with white or blood red paint, torn, slashed, stolen, and otherwise violently assaulted. As Carlton Elliott Smith, a Black UU minister, said Thursday, if people are having that kind of reactivity around a sign in front of a church, what's it like day to day for those of us walking around in black skin? By the way, if you're on Facebook, you can follow Carlton and other Black UUs. There's a new group called Blue, Black Lives of Unitarian Universalism, that has a Facebook page, and they are issuing a lot of really helpful material. Anyway, that highway action was my first encounter with the group that would soon be known as Black Lives Matter Minneapolis. Direct action, disrupting business as usual, keeping the killing of young black people by police in front of the American people. Now, I've been in this movement a long time, and what I noticed is that white people in particular were receiving these invitations in a new way. We were understanding that this was a time to follow the leadership of the young people of color in charge, but to show up. And often we were assigned particular roles as whites, and for those of us who are clergy, often we were assigned to wear clergy garb and to either hold hands or hold our hands up or in some way surround die-ins where people of color laid on the ground for 4.5 minutes commemorating the 4.5 hours that Michael Brown lay in the streets, his body lay in the streets of Ferguson, Missouri, getting no care or attention. And for whites, often it means walking on the outskirts of the marches to deal with the hostility of the people on the edges so that the people of color are spared that hostility. My 18-year-old kid jumped into these bold actions with other young people of color, living the values that I raised this kid with. And I got with my own people, the local UU clergy. The UU clergy, I'm proud to say, largely white, have showed up for demonstration after demonstration, ones that made us uncomfortable, but by showing up, we worked through our fears, and we also showed our willingness to follow this bold new leadership. In December, a mass action was called for at the Mall of America on the Saturday before Christmas. Every bit of me wanted to stay away. I don't like the Mall of America. I avoid it all the time. And I avoid all shopping places right before Christmas. And the likelihood, having watched what was happening in other cities of police in riot gear and tanks being present, made me really want to stay at home. The police were going to the homes of the organizers, telling them not to go, trying to intimidate them out of holding the march. And I thought, well, if the police are coming to their house and they're not intimidated, why should I be intimidated with all the privilege that I have? My colleagues and I were invited to wear our religious garb and, again, to stand silently during the die-in. And many of us were there. We attended trainings that helped us to learn how to be nonviolent and resisting. Hundreds of people did. And we were told that this was not a time to be arrested, that when we were asked to leave, we should in fact leave the third time we were asked. And that was our full intention. Weirdly, we never were exactly asked to leave. We were told repeatedly that we shouldn't be there on a large screen overhead. And there were some 3,000 of us who were there that day. Eventually, we did leave. I was stunned to see when I turned around that all the stores had been shut down. There were grills pulled down. I had actually thought, since I'd gone to the trouble of parking and getting to the Mall of America, I would actually do some Christmas shopping. And I was stunned to see that the mall was completely closed, and I couldn't do that. Because it was a joyful, nonviolent event, just as we'd been trained and just as we had planned. My 18-year-old had volunteered to help keep the peace at the rally. Gia was arrested along with 10 others of the key organizers who were identified when a cop infiltrated a pre-demonstration training. That trial is now in full swing. The judge will tell us by the end of the month which of the charges will stay and which will be dropped. The city of Bloomington and the Mall of America are attempting to charge the demonstrators for the $55,000 spent on riot gear and special equipment, even though none of it was needed. And to kick out the people who are trained in de-escalation and replace them with police in riot gear, when you've been to the training and you've seen exactly that these are the people who are going to keep it peaceful, and in fact you arrest them and boot them out, has to make me wonder what they really wanted the event to become. So now we'll see how this unfolds. My favorite part of that $55,000 is that $3,500 of it is to pay for the pizza that the police ate while they were there. And it being Minnesota, there were no tanks. There were giant snow plows blocking all of the exits. Clergy like me, predominantly white clergy, were in very visible leadership roles at this event. We were not charged with anything. We started a hashtag, charge us too. And we started reaching out with press conferences and direct letters and meetings saying, hey, if you're going to charge the organizers, we're organizers. Leave the young people of color alone. Charge us. And that is not happening. My own child, who's now 19, faces 5 misdemeanor charges, and I had that weird mother activist dual role of going to the trial last week, the pretrial, trying to get Gia to college, to class without missing it. You know, it was crazy, the role that I'm often in now as parent, as activist, as minister. As the year has unfolded, I've accepted many, many invitations. I've marched in the streets, by government buildings, by jails, at the Minnesota State Fair. I've spoken at city council hearings. I've joined the local chapter of the NAACP. And I've helped to start a local chapter of a group for white allies called Surge, Showing Up for Racial Justice. It's a national group, and there are local chapters all over, and you could start one in Appleton. Our Surge chapter has been engaged in a conversations project where we go door to door as white people to talk primarily to other white people about racism. And our reason for doing this is to ask them if they would put a Black Lives Matter sign in their yard in a particular part of city council where the president of the city council says none of her residents want the kinds of things that Black Lives Matter is asking for. If you want to see awkwardness, forget watching white people clap along to hymns. White people talking to other white people about racism is about as awkward as it gets. We can fall into so many pits when we do it. Guilt, shame, self-righteousness, judgment, anger, blame, and so many others. Trying to stay real and grounded and humble and have real conversations so that we can begin to claim our own souls back from this legacy of being the ones who have benefited from centuries of violent suppression. Who teaches us to do that? Where do we get to practice that? Hopefully at church. That's what I'm working on, and that's why we're going door to door. So I haven't received any little white invitations this year, but I've accepted a number of them to places I did not expect, and many of which I would have preferred to say, no, thank you. I'd rather go down to the cafe where Dot knows my name and will make me eggs over easy. No, thanks. I don't want to be the one who doesn't know the idioms and the language, the one unsure of cultural references and not in charge. When Billy Collins describes staying home instead of going to Italy, talking about making it easy on himself, he's describing not only what it is for English speakers in the world, but also what it is for those of us who are white. There's always an easy, comfortable choice. Everything about this culture tells us that who we are and what we already know is everything. We're not missing anything essential. Dot knows our name, she knows how to make our eggs, and the rest of it really doesn't matter much. For me, accepting these invitations is a challenge to that white belief system that lives in my mind. I wade into these waters of discomfort and fear, and I'm relieved that there are so many other white people stepping out there with me. I've been doing some form of racial justice work for decades, mostly within Unitarian Universalism. I interned in a black church in Roxbury, Massachusetts, back when the videos of the police beating of Rodney King prompted nationwide outrage by the black community. At that time, at least in Boston, very few whites came to protest that beating. That's different now. I've never seen white people so engaged and motivated around the work. I think social media has brought into our homes the daily awareness of what people of color are living with. And I am inspired and finding hope both watching and learning from the leadership of this new generation and also from the sheer numbers of white people who keep awkwardly, uncomfortably, fearfully showing up. I was delighted to see the Black Lives Matter sign here and to read of the exchange that you've been having with the police chief, the ministers and the police chief. I watched the September 15th video of the police chief, and in part I was moved and impressed by him. He speaks respectfully of the Black Lives Matter movement. He has clearly looked at the Campaign Zero website to look at their 10-point plan for action. I wish every police chief in the country would do that. But a few matters I was curious about, as what he said did not match what I was reading. He seemed to be saying that the racial discrepancies in arrests in Appleton are a little troubling, but really pretty good. But as I read it, black people in Appleton are 10 times more likely to be arrested than white people. Less than 2% of the population, blacks are 18% of the arrests. And for drug sales or manufacturing, blacks are 20 times more likely to be arrested. So to say that that's not really a problem is to really say that unfairness is not a problem in Appleton. In his Facebook post, the police chief states that Appleton has a review board. But on that interview, when he was asked what would happen if someone claimed racial bias, everything that he named was about coming to the police to report racial bias. So if I were going to issue an invitation to this church and to the Racial Justice Task Force, of whom I've had the pleasure of meeting a few of you, I would urge you to get focused on demanding and creating an independent review board with teeth in it, which allows stories to be told which will otherwise be squelched. You may have other ideas. You know, it can start as simply as just having people here put on a Black Lives Matter button. Walk around town, see what conversations you have, come back and reflect on it together. So if you haven't felt invited into this historic moment, this new civil rights movement, this opportunity to proclaim clearly that when Black lives matter, all lives will matter, consider this your formal invitation. Imagine it in a small envelope with your name on it, coming right to the door of your soul. As Rumi says, move into the moment of your death. Consider what you truly want. Consider what you truly want Appleton to be for all of its citizens. Rumi says, phrase your question and expect the grace of an answer.